History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Hello, everyone. In the last episode, we looked at the Battle of the Somme, and it seemed like very little happened, but that very little cost a terrible price. There were hundreds of thousands of dead, a million casualties on both sides. The British suffered 60,000, was it fatalities or casualties? I forget which one it
was. That was casualties, 20,000 actual dead.
Right, just in the first day of battle, the worst day in British military history up to that point. All in order to move the line of the Western Front 7 miles, in order to free it from the whip of tyranny, as they would say back then. Well, we're going to be moving out of the Western Front, and we're going to be looking at what is happening on the Southern Fronts. This is a part of the theater of World War One that doesn't get as much attention. The technology isn't as flashy. There aren't as many troop numbers, but still very important. And I would argue in at least one of those fronts in the Middle East, if there's a place where World War One is still being felt today, the effects of it and the treaties and agreements and how it has a direct bearing on modern day life and how chaotic it can be, I think that would have to be the Middle East. But we have a lot of places to look at. And the first place to start is looking at the front between Italy and Austria. So what's happening there, James?
This may be the most beautiful of the fronts as far as just the pure landscape, but they're going to try to mess it up as much as possible. So we talked in an earlier episode quite some time ago about how Italy entered the war. Italy had originally been part of the Triple Alliance. They had been allied with Germany and Austria-Hungary. But when the war broke out, they said, psych, sorry, we're not going to go to war. And then eventually they were persuaded by the Allies to join the Allied side. So they're going to fight against Austria. They had territorial goals. They had parts of Austria that had a lot of ethnic Italians that they wanted to take over. Lovely country. Who wouldn't want to own that, right, Scott?
Yeah, I'd try to conquer that too if I could.
Yeah. So since Italy's entry into the war, Italy and Austria had fought several battles along their border in the Alps. Neither side was able to make much headway until May of 1916, when Austria launched what they called the Punishment Expedition. You know, I like that name. And that pushed the Italian army back.
Wait, Austria won?
They won a battle.
Am I mishearing something? That doesn't happen in World War One, does it?
It happens sometimes. Not very often, but here it did, yes. But the Italians were scrappy. They counterattacked in August. And this is 1916. We're going to be talking about mainly events in 1916 and 1917, just so everybody gets some chronology there. The Italian army counterattacked. They captured Gorizia, which the Austrians had previously occupied, but further attempts to advance were halted. Then, throughout the summer and fall of 1916, Austria and Italy continued to fight around the Isonzo River. Things were mostly quiet in the fall and the winter of 1916 and 17. But on May 12th, 1917, the Italians launched another attack. This is the 10th Battle of the Isonzo. There's going to be 12 of these babies. The Italians took Zagora and Mount Santo, but they lost the latter very quickly. The battle ended in early June. It was technically an Italian victory, but they lost twice as many men as the Austrians did. Then in August 18th, 1917, the Italians began the 11th Battle of the Isonzo, attacking along the entire front. This was the deadliest of the Isonzo battles, and it ended on September 12th. Less than a month. Wow, that's a short battle for World War One. October 24th, the Austrians, now joined by the Germans, they launched the 12th Battle of the Isonzo. That's also called the Battle of Caporetto. This was a major victory for the Austrians and Germans. Within 2 days, the Italians had lost 60,000 prisoners and were in flight. The Central Powers forces gained about 60 miles of territory. That's quite a bit for World War One. But the Italians regrouped at the Piave River. And when the battle ended 9 days later, the Italians had lost 10,000 killed and 280,000 prisoners. But despite this, the Italians' morale increased since they're like, yay, we lost. No, I'm just kidding. But they were now fighting for their homeland, not conquest. You know, it's always easier to defend your own territory than to go out and attack somebody else's territory. The Italian commander Luigi Cadorna was fired and replaced by General Armando Diaz. So to sum up what happened in Italy and Austria, it was a lot like the Western Front that we've been talking about. Really kind of a seesaw war, back and forth, back and forth. The Italians would capture a town, then the Austrians would push them back and recapture the town. A lot of these towns changed hands many times.
Yeah, it's kind of a microcosm. It's sort of like a bush league of what's happening on the Western Front. It mirrors it, but it's at a much smaller scale with inferior equipment. I don't know the specs of what they have, but really doubt the Austrians are better equipped than the Germans or the Italians than the British and others.
No, you're right. And what was also interesting about this is how much higher up it was. I mean, if you think of the Western Front, a lot of that is basically at sea level, you know, especially if you're talking about Flanders, and the northern part of the Western Front was very flat, marshy land. This is not that at all. This is up in the Alps. So we're talking when artillery, I mentioned this before, but I think it bears repeating, when artillery shells are fired, they would often crash into the rocks, the mountains, and they would create tiny little splinters of rock that were really great at cutting people to pieces. So, and you know, obviously the air is a lot thinner, and you're having to carry equipment up the side of a mountain or down the side of a mountain, or people, you know, if somebody was injured, you had to get them off of that mountain and get them back to safety. So it was and you had people that were mountain climbers, and you had troops on skis and all kind of interesting things that you definitely don't see on the Western or Eastern Front. So it's really a different kind of war. In some ways it's similar to the Western Front, but in other ways it's very different.
Well, it's if there's anything that increases Italian morale, it could be less frostbite as it gets further into their homeland, if that's anything.
Yeah, no kidding. Exactly. Yeah, I would not want to. I don't think I'd want to fight in any of these fronts, but I think the Alps might be the worst. I don't know. Think of how cold it would be. So now we're going to move on to the Balkans. This is an area, of course, which is near and dear to my heart, having lived in the Balkans for several years. We talked previously about the 1914 and early 1915 invasions of Serbia by Austria. Austria attempted several times to invade Serbia, but the Serbs, even though they were a very small army, as Dan Carlin says, they punched above their weight class. They were tough fighters, they were scrappy, and they kept driving the Austrians back. But this time, it's not going to work out that way, because the Austrians are going to have German help, and also Bulgaria is coming in from the east now. Bulgaria had joined the war. In the winter of 1915-1916, the Serbian army, along with many civilians, fled Serbia. They just basically marched right south and east and out of Serbia into the mountains of Albania, which is not exactly a very hospitable country. Plus, they had Albanian highwaymen and guerrillas attacking them, sniping at them. But they marched through the coast, and about 200,000 people died along the way. This, Scott, is an epic, one of those epic historical moments that people remember back. You know, Americans think about, I don't know, Bunker Hill and Valley Forge and Gettysburg and things like that. D-Day, it's one of those legendary experiences that people remember and people teach their children. I would say after the Battle of Kosovo, this is probably the second most remembered and talked about Serbian experience, this massive exodus out of Serbia. Yeah, they were led also by the Serbian archbishop, and a lot of the church hierarchy left as well. By mid-January 1916, the Allies were taking thousands of Serbs from the Albanian coast, and they moved them to the Greek island of Corfu. So it's like that. We're talking like the Exodus in the Bible. It's a massive, massive event, epic event.
How many were as a part of this procession through the mountains with the civilians and the army and everyone involved? Do you know?
I do not have the exact number written down, and unfortunately I do not recall, but I know it's several hundred thousand, maybe as many as a million. I'll try to look that up in a minute, but if 200,000 died, you know, it's got to be way more than that. So
right.
But yeah, this is a kind of one of those, like I said, just a moment that forged the Serb people into even more of a nation than they already had been. Now, in January, Austria-Hungary invaded Montenegro. Montenegro at that time was an independent kingdom. And within 2 weeks, or principality is probably a better way to say it. Within 2 weeks, the government surrendered, although the army retreated into Albania. You know, Serbs and Montenegrins don't like to give up. The Austrians followed them there. They said, well, what the heck? Let's occupy Albania too. So Austria is spreading their wings to the south, even as they're getting pummeled up in the northern part of their country. Now, we talked about in a previous episode how a force of combined British and French force had landed in Salonika, or modern day Thessaloniki in Greece. Their mission was to march north and to relieve the Serbs, but they were prevented from doing that. They established a major military base at Salonika. And by the way, that's over the objections of many Greeks. Yeah, it's like, hey.
Wait a second. Didn't the Germans start this whole war by doing that? Shh, be quiet, quiet.
Yeah,
quiet.
I know. It's okay for us. It's not okay for the Germans because we're good guys and they're bad guys. And the Greeks said, hey, this is Greece. You cannot do this. But anyway, in Salonika, the British and French, since they weren't able to advance north, they formed a five-nation army. Not quite as impressive as a seven-nation army. Bum, 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 bum. Sorry, I couldn't resist.
That earworm is in your head, listeners, and you can't get it.
Yes, you got it. Look it up. Seven-nation army. Great song. But this is only a five-nation army. So there's French, British, Italian, Serbian, and Greek troops, and it's nearly 750,000 men, so pretty impressive force. They prepared to attack Bulgarian forces to the north, and in the summer they slowly began advancing northward. In November, this is 1916 still, the five-nation army took Monastir in southern Serbia. That's a town that literally means monastery. Meanwhile, the situation in Greece is very interesting. Greece is divided because the king of Greece is a relative of the Kaiser.
Of course. So, everyone is a relative.
Like everybody is. I mean, almost everybody. Who isn't, right? But, you know, when these Balkan nations achieved their independence, they tended to try to import some kind of German prince or something to become their king. It's like you got to be, if you don't have German on your resume, you get rejected immediately. But it didn't occur to them to just put one of their own on the throne. Well, the Serbs tried that, but that didn't work out well either. Anyway, I'm getting off the main track here. Sorry. So Greece was divided into royalists who tended to be more pro-German, but you also had pro-British and French or pro-Allied forces. They were called Venizelists, and they were supporters of the prime minister. It was Eleftherios Venizelos, who was very, very pro-Allied, as I mentioned. A group of Allied troops was actually attacked in Athens by government forces, by royalist forces, and the Allies blockaded Greece and occupied the Cyclades Islands as a result. So the Allies are basically saying, no more Mr. Nice Guy. You know, you will join our forces or we will crush you. Now, back to Serbia in late February 1917, the Toplice Rebellion, which was led by Serbs in Bulgarian-controlled territory in the Balkans, began. It was put down on March 25th, although some guerrilla resistance continued. In March, the French and British forces in Greece advanced northward. The next month, the Allies attacked Bulgarian forces in Macedonia. Now, when I say Macedonia, I'm talking about what is now the modern nation of Macedonia. It is south of Serbia, but north of Greece. The Bulgarians, aided by German naval guns and infantry, fought off the British. So this five-nation army led by the British and the French is really having a hard time moving. The Bulgarians keep slapping them back. Another Allied attack in May failed. In June of 1917, King Constantine of Greece, the guy who I said was related to the Kaiser, he abdicated in favor of his son Alexander. And on the 28th, Greece finally officially joined the Allies. And then a momentous thing happens on July 20th. This is not really a military action. This is more of a political action. But representatives of the Serbs and the Croats and the Slovenes on the island of Corfu they issued the Pact of Corfu, and they were calling for a South Slavic confederation under the leadership of the Serbian royal family. So, and keep in mind that other than Serbia, these people were part of Austria-Hungary. So obviously the Austrians were not happy about this. So you're going to do what? But the Serbs kind of strong-armed and persuade the Croats and the Slovenians, who were part of Austria-Hungary, as I mentioned at that time, to join with them and form what's going to be called the, originally it's called the Kingdom of the Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes, but it's going to eventually change its name to Yugoslavia, and they're going to have a big future. But that's,
oh, yeah,
that's another, another discussion.
I mean, in automotive history, if nothing else, they've gifted us with the Yugo. So they stand on the, they've made a big contribution to world civilization.
Wonderful cuisine too. But so we see the birth of Yugoslavia basically here in 1917, quite a bit before the war actually ends.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
And this is something that we mentioned at the beginning of the series, that World War One is a hinge of history. It's a separation between the old world and the new world in many ways. And one of those is that the idea of an empire as a political entity, which can effectively rule over a large group of people, it was taken for granted that this is an effective means to do so. And before the modern era, I think it really is. When you have many people have many different languages, many different traditions, you don't try to corral them into a nation state. You don't try to have them say the same Pledge of Allegiance or speak the same language or have a common identity that binds them together. You basically say, all right, everyone, do whatever you want to. Just don't rebel. Pay taxes if we ask you to. And if we raise a draft, go fight in the army. Other than that, we don't care what you do. Just do your own thing. That doesn't work in the modern era.
Right.
So some empires are trying to turn themselves from an empire into a nation state. Britain is able to do that very successfully, partly because they do have a common language, a common history. And the way that they treat themselves on the island is very different from how they treat people in the colonies. People in the colonies aren't considered part of this nation state and citizens in the full way. France has boundaries and borders that have existed for a very long time. Germany was able to unite its different principalities in 1871 at Simpler. But as we're going to see here, moving down the list, in a way, other empires are struggling in a much harder way. Austria-Hungary, there are people, especially Slavic peoples, who have been marginalized. They feel no fealty to the Austro-Hungarian emperor. And they think, well, how do we make a nation? We want to make a nation. That's obviously the future. And any of you listeners study political science, you'll get into theories of nationalism. Well, what do we have in common as Serbs and Croats and Slovenes? We have an idea of Slavicness. What is Slavicness? We have languages that are faintly connected, but so do Italians and French who speak Romance languages. Well, what we have is a closer kinship. We're Orthodox by religion. Well, maybe the Croats are raising their hands. Are Croats mostly Catholic, James? I forget.
Yeah, they are. Okay. Slovenes too. Yeah.
All right. So yeah, that's another thing. The Balkans is a complicated place. But so there's an idea of, well, we're part of the same similar ethnic group. We have a familial connection, and that's how we're going to forge these bounds. I'll get more into why. So they're trying to make a common connection with each other when the bonds may not be as strong as they would be in a place like Britain. It's even worse in the Ottoman Empire, but I just wanted to mention that little aside of Yugoslavia. I would say, you know, it is a pragmatic strategy of the world is moving toward a nation state. It's moving away from empire. This is how our small populations can band together and create something stronger and more powerful. So
yeah,
that's my take on it. Any thoughts on that, James, since you lived and experienced it?
Well, you know, a lot of the Croats and Slovenes weren't real tickled pink about this arrangement, but I think at this point in history, it was really too early for all of these peoples to have their own small little tiny nation state. I think they saw strength in sticking together. You know, better to have a Yugoslavia, let's say, with 20 million people than three or four small kingdoms with 5 million people each, right? Okay. So the same thing is going to happen with Czechoslovakia. The Czechs and the Slovaks are not the same exact people. They have a similar language, similar culture, but they're also different in many ways. So, but they're going to band together in Czechoslovakia because they felt it would be stronger than to try to just each go it alone. And we're going to see, you know, if you know your modern history, these coalitions are going to fall apart much later in the 1990s, but that's a whole nother podcast series. I don't even know if we're going to, I don't know if we're going to do that one, but
I mean, when you have a NATO security umbrella over you, it gives you a little bit more flexibility than when you're on your own.
Right. Yeah. And I want to say one other thing, this Pact of Corfu, or Corfu Declaration, as it's sometimes called, is a huge deal because this is the first major chunk of Austria-Hungary to secede. Basically, they're basically declaring their secession from Austria-Hungary. They're the first, but they're definitely not going to be the last. Speaking of that, let's move over to Romania. Romania is the eastern neighbor of Austria-Hungary, and as we've already mentioned, the province of Transylvania, which is, it's in Austria-Hungary, but it's primarily peopled by people of Romanian ethnicity. So Romania wants to try to get that into Romania and out of Austria-Hungary, as do many of the people there. But of course, there's also Hungarian. So it's very, very complicated. It's a mess. In August 1916, Romania joined the war on the side of the Allies. They were encouraged a lot by the Brusilov offensive and its success. But this is terrible timing, Scott. Absolutely. It's like, we're joining the war. Pow! Ugh. I mean, whoops, I almost lost my mic. I should not have pounded on the table like that, I suppose. But maybe you should have done this a little earlier. They were kind of trying to shop around and see which alliance would be better. They finally went on the side of the Allies. But as soon as they do, a joint Bulgarian and Turkish force commanded by German General August von Mackensen invaded from the south. So it's like, we're in, and here come the Turks, and here come the Bulgarians. It's kind
of
funny.
We were just fighting a war a few years ago.
Yeah, I know. War can make strange bedfellows. I was just thinking that too, Scott. I mean, our listeners may or may not know that the Bulgarians and the Turks had fought for a long time.
Somewhere between, and there were the Balkan Wars in 1912 and 1913, Bulgarian independence in 1878, and then several centuries of warfare before then. So it's a long story, listeners.
Yeah, and now they're on the same side. But anyway, at the same time as this attack from the south, German and Austrian forces under our old buddy Erich von Falkenhayn, who was recently demoted from the top spot in the German army. Now he's an army commander going into Romania. They invaded from the west. So that's a 1-2 punch against Romania, which is not a large country. They do not have a great big army. Russia tried to send help, but it took them a long time for their forces to arrive. Russians are not famous. The Russian army is not famous for its speed at this time in history. And in December of 1916, the Central Powers captured Bucharest. So there's another capital to fall into the hands of the Central Powers. The defenders had destroyed as much grain and oil as possible, but much still fell into the attackers' hands. The listeners, you guys may or may not know this, but Romania has a lot of oil fields, the Polesti oil fields. I don't know if I said that right, but they are something that everybody's always fighting over. Everybody wants that oil, especially in the modern age when oil is becoming more and more important. And they have, it's really a breadbasket too. And the Germans end up, and the Austrians end up with quite a bit of this. The fighting in Romania mostly ceased for a while for the winter. It kicks off again in the summer of 1917. The Romanians recruited new soldiers, including some who had formerly fought in the Austrian army. So we see a lot of switching sides. In early August, the Russian and Romanian forces pushed back the Central Powers a bit, but the Central Powers fought back and soon defeated the Russians. And on December 5th, 1917, Romania surrenders, basically. They give up. They cease hostilities. So they're only in the war for, a year and 4 months or so? So the Romanians don't really, they don't get off to a good start, and it never gets better. So Romania is knocked out of the war. All right. So they gave it the old college try, but they just were surrounded by some very powerful forces. All right. So we're going to move down to the Middle East right now. And Scott has a few things to talk about to set us up. And then we'll talk about some of the specific battles and other things that went on there.
Yeah, well, a lot of what we talked about, what's happening in the Austro-Hungarian Empire and centripetal forces, centrifugal forces, not sure which one is the right there.
Centrifugal, they're fleeing the center, basically.
There we go. Centrifugal forces are pulling apart the Ottoman Empire, much in the same way as the Austro-Hungarian Empire is. We talked about how an empire is trying to make the transition into a nation state. The Ottoman Empire could arguably have even more problems than the Austro-Hungarian Empire did. In its glory days in the 16th, 17th centuries, really up into the, well into the 19th century, it controls much of the Balkans. Many Balkan peoples were under Ottoman power. Anatolia, which is modern day Turkey, North Africa, but mostly Egypt, and then the entire Arabian Peninsula, which is Saudi Arabia, Oman, Yemen, that whole area, is under Ottoman power. After the Balkan Wars, the Balkan nations have independence, which the Balkans used to be the heartland of the Ottoman Empire. In fact, many of the commanders of the Ottoman Empire, the generals who ran the army, were Albanian in background and grew up in Albania. Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, who I sung his praises to the highest heavens in our Gallipoli episode, also grew up in the Balkans. That's all gone. The Ottoman Empire now is Turkey or Anatolia and the Arabian Peninsula. While you have a Turkish-speaking population, you have an Arabic-speaking population, and the two don't have a lot of historical connections with one another. There's some people at the high levels of government who are trying to form a common identity as Ottomans, but the idea of being an Ottoman as an identity has very, very little purchase outside of elite circle. It doesn't mean anything. Most people, if you ask them their identity, they would mention their religion first and foremost, whether they're Christian, whether they're Muslim, whether they're Jewish, all of which exist in the Ottoman Empire. To be an Arab or a Turk, those ethnic categories, that's more of an elite conversation that really doesn't come along until farther into the 20th century. But for centuries, these different populations had existed as a marriage of convenience under the umbrella of the Ottoman Empire. It's not convenient anymore. There's not a compelling reason to remain in the empire if independence is possible or your vested interests in Arabia do not align with those with the military command in Istanbul. So that's a little bit of the background there, but and that'll make sense of how the empire is cracking up and also how allied forces are seeing opportunities to quicken this cracking up and be able to exploit it to their advantage. But that's a long preamble. What is happening in the Middle East, James?
Yeah, so the Russians and the British are both going to start chipping away at the Ottoman Empire in different ways. In mid-February of 1916, a Russian force that had crossed the Caucasus Mountains, they took the port city of Erzurum. How do you say that, Scott?
Erzurum.
Erzurum. Okay, I wasn't even close, but sorry, I don't know Turkish. Soon afterward, they took Trabzon. I do know how to say that. And they began to advance on Bitlis. How do you say that?
Yeah, that's right.
Hey, hooray for me. Which was the gateway to Mesopotamia. So the Turks really didn't want to let the Russians get past there and into Mesopotamia. In fact, the British really didn't either, even though they're technically on the same side. In the winter and spring of 1916, the British sent several expeditions to relieve their trapped force at Kut al-Amara. And we have to remember, going back to 1915, the British had sent an expedition to Basra, and then they had marched up the Euphrates or the Tigris? Doggone Tigris, right? They marched. Which one is it, Scott? Do you remember?
I think it's Euphrates, but I could be wrong.
Well, the
Euphrates is farther west.
Okay, so it must be I don't know. I'm sorry, folks, but it's in modern-day Iraq. I know that.
Both rivers are, so we're right, whatever it is.
They're heading up. It's one of those two, right? Yeah, headed up toward heading eventually for Baghdad, but they got trapped in a fortress town called Kut al-Amara, and they were under siege. The British are trying to send relief forces to help these guys break out, but none of them works. And finally, the British garrison at Kut, for short, they surrendered on April 29th, 1916. And the 12,000 British and Indian garrison forces was marched off to Baghdad in a death march. It was very much in some ways like the more famous Bataan death march in World War II. They were sent to prison camps in Anatolia, and what turned, as I said, was really just a death march. 70% of the British and about 30% of the Indian soldiers died. And you can see photos of some of these Indian soldiers who refused to eat what was offered to them. I can't remember if they were offered cow or whatever, but they didn't. Eating the food was against their religion, so they almost starved to death. They look like human skeletons. Now, in May of 1916, a political development occurs. Major, hugely significant event. A treaty was signed by the French and the British with Russian approval, known as the Sykes-Picot Treaty. And the treaty divided the Ottoman holdings in the Middle East into zones of influence. It took no notice of cultural, religious, or ethnic boundaries. So here we see, well before the war is over, Britain and France are already carving up what we today call the Middle East, the southern parts of the Ottoman Empire. And, oh, man, that, as Scott has hinted before, that has ramifications that echo right down to the present. Right, Scott?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'll mention some here, because if I save all of this for our final episode on the legacies of World War One, I think it'll get larded down a little bit too much.
Hey, everyone. Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
As we mentioned in previous episodes, the Eastern question of what is to be done with the Ottoman Empire and how can it fall under the purview of Western colonial powers is a question that goes back for centuries. Catherine the Great was thinking about capturing Constantinople, making it the crown jewel of Eastern Orthodox Christendom once again, making the Hagia Sophia a cathedral once again, most importantly, having a warm water port, if we really get down to it. But the Sykes-Picot Agreement has major ramifications, and it is still remembered in the Middle East today. If you are at all interested in the Middle East and want to know more, you need to study this aspect of World War One. One example, I mean, I could think of thousands, but when Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the now dead leader of ISIS, announced that the group was going to establish a new nation, he said, "We will not stop until we hit the last nail in the coffin of the Sykes-Picot conspiracy."
Oh, wow. So, I didn't know he said that. That's
so
amazing.
When you're running the militarist, although he does have a PhD in Islamic studies, when a terrorist knows it, I mean, someone who is a fanatic will have casual understanding of it because they see this as a longstanding conspiracy by the West to weaken the Middle East. And like James says, it's a secret agreement. But what it did was it determined the spheres of influence in the Ottoman Empire and its eventual partition. It's sort of like with the conference with Winston Churchill, FDR, and Stalin in 1945 of how will
Yalta,
how will the post-World War II order look like? Who will have zones of influence? Well, this meeting in 1916, it's based on the belief that the Ottomans will be defeated. So what it led to is British control of today's Israel and Palestine and Jordan and Iraq. Then the ports of Haifa and Acre, and which is in Lebanon, that's what Britain would also get access to the Mediterranean. France would get southeastern Turkey, the city of Marash, northern Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. In terms of boundaries not respecting nations, like James said, Iraq, the nation that we know today, was formed by three Ottoman provinces that have no historical connection with each other. One is dominated by Shias, one's dominated by Sunnis, one's dominated by Kurds. So once Saddam Hussein exits the picture with the Iraq war, there's a massive insurgency and people are fighting each other because there's not a strong man to stop them because these three groups don't consider themselves Iraqis because there was no Iraq. It was sort of a fiction created by Western powers to force these three groups into each other. It'd be like if Canada, America, and Mexico were forced into a super nation by an outside power, and they don't particularly like each other. One part of Iraq was cut off from Kuwait, which it did have historical connections, which could explain the regular Gulf War. And the king in Iraq was a Hashemite from the Arabian Peninsula. He was thrown out of Syria. So was the king of Jordan. And anyway, there's the boundary lines of Jordan. There's a legend that Winston Churchill drew the boundary line after having a few too many martinis at lunch and that's why it's so crooked and contorted. Nice story, not true, but that's how it goes.
Well, the martini part is believable, at least.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, that goes without saying. I mean, that would I would question any historian who didn't believe it, but that a map that would have binding political authority that would just be drawn by someone scribbling, that's a little bit far-fetched and out there, but it showed that the idea is still believed by so many people is because the idea that the plans for the Middle East were so ramshackle and thrown together that today you had the legacy of nations where you have groups of people stuffed in and forced to identify that have little in common with one another. They don't have a national identity. They don't have a common heritage. There's tribe, there's ethnic group, there's maybe an Ottoman era province that they were, but very little, it means very little to be a Syrian or an Iraqi. And if that gives any help in understanding the civil wars and infighting in those nations today, much of that is a legacy of World War One.
Yeah, and there's a classic book on this that I highly recommend. I know Scott and I have talked about it, and he likes it a lot too. It's called A Peace to End All Peace.
Yes.
And it's been over 30 years since that was written. It was published in 1989, but it is just a fantastic, comprehensive, sweeping overview of the formation of the modern Middle East. I highly recommend. In fact, I'm rereading it right now, even as we speak. I love that book. All right. So the Ottoman Empire in what we would call the Middle East begins to really start falling apart in the middle of 1916. In June 1916, encouraged by the British, Hussein bin Ali, who was the Sharif and the Emir of Mecca, he and his sons proclaimed a revolt against the Ottomans. It's called the Arab Revolt. It's very creative, but and Arab forces, aided and financed by the British, began capturing cities. By mid-July, they had captured Jeddah and Mecca, and soon after they took Yanbo, which is the port of Medina. In December, meanwhile, it's the Tigris, Scott. Oh,
we were close.
Yeah, the Tigris. Sorry. The British had, as we mentioned earlier, they had sent a force up the Tigris, which had gotten stranded in Kut al-Amara and captured and sent into exile. Now they send a second force up toward Kut al-Amara. And another force captured El Arish, which is in Palestine. So the British are hitting them everywhere. Plus, Arabs are rising up in rebellion. It's really looking bad for the Ottomans. On March 11, 1917, Allied forces recaptured Kut, and then they took Baghdad. So they finally achieved their goal. On the 26th of that month, British forces in Egypt marched on Gaza, but they were turned back by Turkish forces guarding it. And a second attack in April also failed. So the Turks aren't done yet. They're not just going to roll over and die. They're going to fight. On April 21st, the British captured Istanbulat, and this ended any Ottoman hopes for regaining a strategic stronghold in the region. On July 2nd, Arab forces led by a very colorful character, T.E. Lawrence, a.k.a. Lawrence of Arabia, they captured the key port city of Aqaba, and this provided a base relatively close to Suez in Syria. It was a major accomplishment, getting that port naval, well, not a naval base, but a port. In late September, British forces defeated the Ottomans on the Euphrates River. So there, now we got both of the rivers. We've got control, the British do, of both rivers. This is near Ramadiya, which is north of Baghdad. On October 3rd, T.E. Lawrence and his forces blew up part of the Hejaz Railway, which is a major transport network for the Ottomans. Now it's gone. On October 31st, General Edwin Allenby led an attack on Beersheba. A cavalry charge was a key part of the attack. So cavalry is not completely dead yet. It's still important in at least some parts of the war. And a week later, Gaza fell to Allied forces, and further towns soon fell. And then finally, on December 7th, 1917, the crown jewel of the Middle East, the city of Jerusalem, surrendered to the Allies. The British, that was really, I would say, of more symbolic significance than it was strategic significance. It's not like Jerusalem was a major military base or anything, but hey, it's Jerusalem, right? I mean, it's the city everybody wants. And that's going to look good in the newspapers. The British commander, General Allenby, read a proclamation guaranteeing the sanctity of the city. And that Christmas, And on Christmas of 1917, the British and the other allies celebrated Christmas in Jerusalem. How cool was that?
Yeah, majorly. And I was going to say an elegy of the Ottoman Empire, but I think we'll save it for a later episode because they're not quite done. I won't get into the whole armistice and everything else. I will mention a different thing, though. This isn't directly related to World War One, but it does have to do with how much World War One affects our understanding of the past, even things that happened a long time ago. And this thing that James talked about right here, where the British take Jerusalem, strategically, not significant at all. Symbolically, I don't think there's a more symbolically important city on planet Earth. Is there any other city that's important to three major religions? As it's, well, not beating heart for Islam, but for two other religions, it's a pretty big deal. So
yeah, I mean, it's important to Islam too, but no, there's no other city that has anywhere near this much significance to as many different believers.
Well, one of the reasons is the historical significance, of course, is not lost on the British. And we mentioned in other battles where when the Germans or Russians retake a town, they're recalling the Teutonic Knights of the Middle Ages. They're very aware of history and how they're sort of avenging a loss. Well, when the British come in, they very much have the Crusades on the minds. They're talking about Godfrey of Bouillon and other crusaders of the First Crusade who take the city in 1095. And something I mentioned in a class I taught on history of Christian-Muslim relations at a university is that the idea that the Crusades, which is very active amongst those in the Middle East today, they see the Crusades as sort of the first wave of Western colonialism, and World War One was a next part of that, and the Sykes-Picot Agreement and other things too. The idea that the Crusades lingered in the Middle East from the 11th century and they were just waiting to strike back, that's a complete fiction. In the Middle East, those who were attacked by Crusaders thought very little of it at the time. Contemporary records of the time by Muslims written in Arabic say very little about them, because at the end of the day, it's basically a few towns. It's a few cities along the coast, and it only lasts about 100 years. They're much more concerned about the Mongol threat, which kills millions of people and completely levels Baghdad. It's not until you get into the 19th century, and even when Kaiser Wilhelm visits the Middle East and he lays a wreath at the Tomb of Saladin. The Tomb of Saladin in Damascus is in complete ruins, and no one really cares about Saladin, even though he defeated Richard the Lionheart in the Third Crusade. But it's when the British come in and are using the rhetoric that we're sort of the modern-day crusaders, that's where this enters into the discourse of the Middle East, where people there are talking about the Crusades and that this it's sort of a politicization of memory that happens. So World War One is a big deal. It doesn't just affect the period and the date it took place. It affects the memory of things that even happened before then. So wanted to throw that out there as a guy who studied World War One, but also the period long before it. It's interesting to see how the way that we remember the past, it's altered at certain times in history. So even the way we remember the Crusade, which was mostly this kind of romantic, noble, chivalrous affair, and Walter Scott's Ivanhoe and the like, is affected by World War One, where today we think of the Crusades as this long history of a clash of civilizations between East and West, and World War One contributed to that. So just wanted to throw that in.
All right. That's our wrap up of the Southern Fronts in 1916 and 1917. So we're going to next time move into 1917 proper. We are going to, I believe if I recall correctly, we are going to move back out to the East and talk about a very critical event. The first major power of the war is going to be knocked out, and we're going to discuss the Russian Revolution.
All right. That also has long-term implications. So
yeah, just a few.
just a couple. Has a little bit of effect on the 20th century. All right. Well, we'll get all into that and talk about what the fallout is in the next episode. There we go. That wraps up everything for today's episode. First off, I'd like to thank History Unplugged's Spy Masters, which you can easily become, and I'll explain what that is after listing them off. They are, in no particular order, Baron Fraza, Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Josh Reddick, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivey, Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars, WMWGuitars.com, Los, Sergeant Hooch, Sumo 41, and Willie from New Jersey. Now, having thanked my spy masters, I'd like to mention some ways you can get more involved with what I'm doing with History Unplugged. First, if you want to comment on the most recent episodes, you can check out the History Unplugged Facebook or YouTube page, which are video recordings of all the episodes, and they often come out before the audio episodes do. Second, please like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps the show grow and find new listeners. Finally, the best way you can get involved is to join History Unplugged's membership program called the Knowlton's Rangers. This is the place where you can directly partner with me when it comes to the creation of the sorts of episodes I do, or I can most directly talk with you, the listener. I call it the Knowlton's Rangers because they were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War. Go to patreon.com/unplugged and you can join at three levels. Join at the Scout level, you'll get early access to all new episodes and completely ad-free episodes, and I have about 500 by now. Join at the Intelligence Officer level. You get all the same stuff as level one, and you also get premium episodes. I'm doing a series on the life of Audie Murphy, on Americans who fought in World War I for the French Foreign Legion, and another series on Teddy Roosevelt's adventures in the Dakota Badlands. I have about 50 or so of these episodes now. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you get all the things from the first two tiers. You get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get three hardcover books, and you can ask me a question on absolutely anything in history, and I will devote an entire episode to answering it. So check out all those bonuses by going to patreon.com/unplugged. Listeners, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.